Hey, good morning, everybody. You can have a seat. Let me start by stating the obvious. I am not Pastor Dan, all right? We could go into all the ways in which I am not Pastor Dan, but it might be embarrassing to me, all right? So my name is Yon. I'm one of the pastors here, and I have the privilege of wrapping up our Gospel in Work series as we talk about the traps of work this morning. We'll jump right into our big idea, is that from idleness to idolatry, God's grace redeems all of humanity's broken work. One of the things that I love so much about this Gospel and Work series is that I have the opportunity to glean a lot from what Pastor Dan has said, from the book that we're going through, because I am a part-time pastor. That doesn't mean I take my pastor hat off when I walk out the door here, but vocationally, in terms of professionally, and pay-wise, I'm a part-time pastor. So that means I have a couple other jobs to support the family. I am an entrepreneur, so I am a partner in a local gym. I have my own little leadership coaching and consulting company, and I teach up at SU, all right, in the MBA program. So I love the fact that I can sit here and listen and apply all of these things to my own life in my own work, and especially the stuff that I prepped for today in terms of the idleness and the idolatry of our work. And really what we've been talking about, the reason that we have to have sermon series about how the gospel informs our work as Christians is because at the base level, our work is really broken, all right? The way humans engage with work is not healthy, and we can't seem to fix it ourselves. We see kind of way back in the book of Genesis, after Adam and Eve sin, God says, he says, your work is now cursed. You're going to sweat and you're going to toil. You're going to get some fruit, but it's going to be by the sweat of your brow, and it's going to be hard, right? And he says at the end of that little piece, it says, you're going to keep working and sweating and struggling until you return for the dust from whence you came, right? It's like, oh, great. Hey, that's fantastic, right? But I think if you probably have a job, and when we talk about work, we're not only narrowing it down to just a profession, like a job where you get paid. We kind of expand that definition to like vocation, the thing that you're called to do, including if you're a full-time mom, then that's your job, right? That's your work. If you're a full-time grandparent, that's your job. If you're a full-time volunteer, all these different things fall into that bucket of a vocation. And so all of this applies to everybody. And so you probably know at some point, if you've interacted with a human being or you've tried to do something with a group of people, accomplish something, that it never really works out the way it's supposed to work, right? Because at the base level, work is broken. One of the ways that I experienced this, I spent 13 years in the Marine Corps infantry, some as an enlisted guy and some as the majority as an officer, so I got out as a captain a couple years ago. And one of the first illustrations that came to mind when I was thinking about the brokenness of work was a training event that my Marines did a couple years ago. And what happens is I was a reservist, so that means you train one weekend a month, and then in the summer you go do 2 weeks of training and do kind of more extended stuff. And so one time I was the executive officer, that means I was the number two person in the company, a couple hundred people in a company. So we all flew out to 29 Palms, California, and which I can tell you there's no palm trees in 29 Palms, California. That is a desert, right? And the reason we go there is because it's a giant desert. You can just shoot things that explode in any direction, all right? So it's pretty great. It's pretty fantastic. But what they do is they evaluate you. They evaluate every platoon and company to make sure that you know what you're doing when it comes to warfighting, to make sure you're deployable. Right, and so we did this training. We did these 2 weeks of training in the desert. Our guys crushed it. If you are a nerd about anything military, it was the most beautiful symphony of explosions and bullets and things you've ever seen. Right, we're shooting artillery from multiple 15 kilometers away. We're layering that. We have air support. We have tanks. We're layering that in with machine guns and mortars. And eventually, all of that beautiful symphony ends up with some little guys, my guys, running up on the objective and taking it. Right, so It was a thing of beauty, right? And so we actually scored pretty well for reservists. We actually scored in the top 15% of all Marine Corps units, which is active duty. You guys do it full time, right? So we're pretty happy. We came back from our training, and it's about Sunday, right? So we got to get back to our jobs on Monday. It's probably around 5 o'clock. We plan on leaving. And one of my jobs as the executive officer is to count all the serialized stuff in the armory, right? We count it all out, make sure we have it all. And then before I do this, as we're prepping, I get one of my sergeants comes up and he's like, sir, there's a problem. And I was like, oh yeah, what's that? They're like, we've lost a magazine. And I was like, oh, you lost your Home and Garden magazine? Then why is that my problem? Yeah. No. If you know anything about the way guns work and stuff, a magazine is a thing that you put bullets into, and then you put that magazine into a gun, and it feeds the rounds, right? So we lost a magazine of 30 rounds, which were security rounds, because Marines don't travel anywhere without, if someone's going to shoot at us, you know, we're going to plan to shoot back, right? So security for the whole travel, but we lost one of them. We couldn't find one. So naturally, like, okay, we'll look for it, right? We start at our level and we start looking everywhere. So can't find it. Next thing is, okay, everyone dumps their gear. Everyone dumps all their stuff. 2 weeks worth of gear that they packed up, ready to go home, dump it all. You search, you literally pat down every Marine all the way down, make sure you can't find it. Then we search the building. We're lifting ceiling tiles up. It's like a 50,000 square foot building. So we finally is, okay, we can't find it. So we have to tell our boss, who's not there, our company commander, he knew, but he's got to call his boss and say, sir, we can't find a magazine. And what does he say? Well, have you looked for it? Yes, we'll look again. Okay, so we do the exact same thing, right? We're looking the exact same thing. And then we still can't find it. So now, in the way the Marine Corps works, you never want to be caught with the hot potato of information. So he tells his boss. So now we're really going up, and it's like, okay, well, we told him, the regimental commander, what did he say? He said, look for it again. We're like, okay. So we literally do the same thing. And so this whole process is unfolding, and during it, you can imagine that we're all just saying, like, good Lord, where is this thing? Please just have it fall out of the sky. We just want to go home. And so we tell our guys, we're like, okay, we set up these little things. We say, okay, there's an amnesty vehicle in the parking lot. What that means is Gunnery Sergeant Drake, he's got a blacked out SUV. We're going to turn the lights off. We're all just going to wander around. And if you happen to have it, or you know where it is, just put it in that vehicle. No one will know. You won't get in trouble. But we just want this stupid magazine to be found, right? It doesn't work, right? Can't find it. So comes around like 11:59 p.m., and that's problematic for the Marine Corps because if you stay into 12:01, they got to pay you more money, all right? So that's when the search kind of ends. They're like, okay, we can't find it, take a bunch of statements. And then one of our sergeants goes out, and he's parked right next to the amnesty vehicle, and he opens up his door, and there's a magazine on his front seat. So what does that mean? That means that some little, I won't say turd or scum sucker, because you can't say that in church, but some Marine had this thing. It wasn't the sergeant. He didn't have it, right? He had it, knew it, hid it through all the inspections, all the searches, and then was gutless and didn't want to admit it, and so put it on this car seat. So the whole reputation of our company is now ruined because we have one person who was selfish and prideful and wouldn't admit it. So all that great work we did, all that stuff I talked about, the beautiful symmetry, the artwork of all the high scores we got, you know what our bosses knew? They knew there was a lack of command and control. They moved me to Maine. They moved a company commander somewhere else. They're like, yo, you guys are all too comfortable with each other. And they blew that whole little situation up, right? Why? Because one person. And you probably may experience this in your own work. Maybe you work in a company, you go on a little leadership retreat, you're like, hey, we're trusting each other, we have all these commitments, and you come back to work, and 2 days later, well, Jimmy talked bad about me, and now it's all ruined, right? We've ruined it all, right? Or you're in a meeting, and you did all this hard work, and your boss takes credit for it. And you're like, wait a minute, that was my job. My boss said he was going to give me credit, but then he took all the credit, right? We experience the fact that work is broken all the time, right? Because if it weren't broken, we would have figured it out by now. We're a couple 10,000, 15,000 years into humanity's existence, and we're still dealing with the same problems, right? We keep kind of think we're making progress, but we're still some pretty big problems, right? Societally. And so when we think of the brokenness of work, we're going to talk specifically about two ways in which that brokenness manifests in our lives as we work and as we navigate our vocation. And the first one, it kind of runs a spectrum. The first one is idleness, which is an under-identification in our work, and we'll talk about that. And the other end is idolatry, which is an over-identification with our work. And so we are going to either find ourselves on one end of the spectrum or bouncing in between on the regular in our vocation as we go about living our lives. And then ultimately, we're going to talk about how God's grace redeems our brokenness in as we go and live in our vocation, right? And one of the passage that we're going to look at that kind of helps illustrate this is a parable that Jesus tells, and it's in Matthew 20, verses 1 through 16. It's a parable about the vineyard workers. So you're going to see it on the screen behind me. I told Pastor Dan, I'm sorry, I didn't bring my hard copy Bible, all right? So he fired me. He said, you're done after today, right? So But you can see it behind me. We'll read through the whole thing. It says, Jesus is talking to his disciples, and he says, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And to them he said, 'You go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right, I will give you.' So they went. Going out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same. And about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing. And he said to them, 'Why do you stand here idle all day?' They said to him, 'Because no one has hired us.' He said to them, 'You go into the vineyard too.' And when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, 'Call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first.' And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. Now, when those hired first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. And on receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house, saying, 'These last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorched heat.' But he replied to one of them, 'Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last worker as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or did you begrudge my generosity?' So the last will be first, and the first will be last." We're kind of hit kind of right off the bat in the way this master of the house interacts with people that he meets going out looking for workers, right? The master of the house goes out five times, right? Five times. On the first time, just to give you an idea of what they mean by first hour, 11th hour, in the Jewish tradition, first century AD, their workday ran from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., right? So there's 12 hours in there. So he went out at 6 a.m. to try to find some workers. Found some workers, hired them, good to go. They're going working for the day. Came back out in the third hour, it says, right? So around 9 a.m., shows up and does the same thing. But at 9, 12, and 3 o'clock, there's a little word in there that is included. And it says, the master of the house found people standing idle in the marketplace. He hires them. They go to work. The last time, it comes around the 11th hour, which is, it says, around the 11th hour, which means like around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Work ends at 6. They're working less than an hour. And he actually poses the question, why do you stand here idle all day? Right? So right off the bat, we see, okay, so 4 out of the 5 times that this master of the house goes out to hire people, he confronts idleness. There's an acknowledgement that they're idle, just doing nothing, right? And so what he's really asking is, why are you standing there without a purpose, without work, and even being lazy? And the reason that we know that is because that's the literal definition of the word idle, right? It means without purpose, without meaning, without work, and lazy, right? So we see this master of the house show up and he's asking. But at the end, he says, he actually poses the question, why are you standing around idle all day? And it's interesting that the answer he gets is a pretty lame one, if you ask me, right? Well, because nobody hired us. Well, that's a great idea. That's a great answer. It's like, oh, okay, well, fair enough. No, it's like, that's a pretty lame. Let me ask you, in your job, when your boss comes to you and they're like, hey, why aren't you doing this? You're like, well, no one told me to do that. Are they like, oh, okay, no problem? No, they're probably like, what? I know in the Marine Corps, when I walk up on a couple of private first class and they're just malingering around doing nothing, which they tend to do, which I was one of them, so I know, but they try to hide and not do anything, right? And a leader walks up and they're like, hey, why are you just standing around here? When they say, well, no one told me to do anything, right? The first thing you learn in boot camp is the word initiative, right? You take initiative to do something, right? And so these workers are standing around doing nothing. Now, I want to make sure I delineate the fact that, you know, these people are standing around doing nothing, being lazy. That is separate from maybe some of the ideas in which we think of we don't do stuff where we may have gotten laid off from a job, right? That's not really that's not the equivalent, right? I'm not saying you're idle and you're lazy, right? It just means circumstances are you don't necessarily have a profession or a vocation right now. Maybe it's the fact that you're actively looking for a job and it's not working out right now. I know that that's stressful, but so if you're sitting here, maybe you spend a lot of time volunteering and you don't have a job. Please don't hear that if you don't have a job and you're actively looking for one that you're in the wrong, right? We just want to make sure we put a caveat to that. But what happens is this worker comes up and they say, well, no one hired us, right? Which is kind of funny because where are they standing? They're standing in the middle of a marketplace, right? It's like they're hanging out in the middle of a marketplace where I'm sure there's other vendors. It's not a marketplace unless there's other vendors, right? There's probably an opportunity to say, hey, maybe you want to hire me? Hey, you're selling fruits and vegetables. You want to hire me? I'll sweep the floor. I'll do whatever you need me to do, right? It's almost like if you were to send your teenager off to go get a job and you send them to the mall and they come back and you're like, hey, how'd it go? Did you get a job? No, no one would hire us. Well, what'd you do? Well, I just kind of sat in the food court. Oh, so you like applied for jobs in the food court? No, I just kind of sat there. And then no one came and offered me a job. Oh, okay, that's great. Now, that's not exactly how it works, right? But, and then also, it's a little bit different because we know that at 6 a.m., there was people there and they got hired, right? So these other guys are standing around. You know, at some point they might say, maybe I'm gonna ask these people who've been in the marketplace if they know anyone who's hiring. Like, hey, you sell fruits and vegetables. Anyone come in here hiring anybody? And say, okay, they did? Oh, that vineyard did? Okay, I'm gonna go to the vineyard and see if I can get a job, right? It's just kind of this very passive laissez-faire, I'm gonna hang out, right? I'm not really gonna do much. I'm gonna stand here idle, and they get challenged by the master of the house saying, why do you stand here idle all day? Because nobody hired us, right? And this is problematic in that they are under-identifying with this, something that Pastor Dan spoke about, I think, in our first week of this series, with the idea that humanity is created to work. We are created before the fall, before sin entered the world. God created us in his image to work, to do things, and to contribute to culture. And this is problematic in the Christian faith because when you go all the way back to Genesis, there's this passage where God says, be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth, subdue it, and rule over it, right? So there's this, I'm not gonna re-preach Pastor Dan's service, his sermon, it's really good, so go check it out. But we are created with this mandate, and then what theologians call a culture mandate, right? It's the problem with idleness and not identifying and just sitting around doing nothing is the fact that God created us to work, and God invites us into work, and we can't just kind of say, well, you know what, I'm just gonna pass on that one for today, right? I'm just gonna take the day off. And that's distinct from what we talked about last week, where we talked about rest, right? Very distinct from the fact that there is a day of the week that we are supposed to rest, because that is a demonstration of our reliance on God, that we cannot change everything, right? We rely on who God is and what he's doing in our lives. That's different. When we have idleness, when we fail to identify with the cultural mandate that God gave us. And one of the things that you might be thinking is, well, you know what, I got a job. I'm okay. I'm just gonna sit out for the rest of this message, right? I got a job, I work pretty hard, I work 80 hours a week, I can relate, you know, I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, go work, you know, I get it, right? But one of the things that you were gonna find is that in Scripture, it's not just, the definition isn't just reserved for people who don't do anything. Idleness is also included in the fact that there's idleness in work, right? When we think of the cultural mandate God gave us in Genesis, it was the idea, it wasn't just Adam and Eve, okay, go dig some trenches, go do some farming, grow some plants. No, it was cultivate the earth and subdue it. What God was saying is God is projecting into the future all the things that humanity is going to do as well, to include things like, little things like inventing music, inventing like metallurgy, inventing a rocket that breaks free from the confines of gravity and shoots us into space, maybe even the splitting of the atom. This is the level of cultural mandate God is giving to Adam and Eve. And now you may not be a physicist. Is that who does the splitting of the atoms? Physicists, right? Yeah, I don't know, right? You may not be a rocket scientist. You may not be a brain surgeon, but you live under the same mandate from God is that we are called to create culture and to contribute to the renewal of all things. And after the fall, we get invited as Christians into not only creating culture, but into the renewal of creation. That's a big job. And so when it comes to idleness, it's not just not doing anything. It's the fact that if we are not in our role, in our job, in our vocation, contributing to the renewal of all things, and on the same level as a physicist is splitting the atom and a rocket scientist is shooting people to the moon, that's how we should identify in our current role. And so that's one of the problems with idleness, is that in our Christian faith, in Christianity, we are called and created to work and to create culture. So you might be wondering, now I don't know if I'm idle in my work or not. You might be thinking, well, how do I know? How do I know? I know that if I, you know, maybe I'm a rocket scientist and I don't know. No one's told me, right? Maybe I'm really actually meant to build a rocket ship, but I'm being idle in my work. There's a couple identifiers that we have, though you can do some self-assessment. And we'll look at those really quickly. The first one is an identifier number one. It's this: your work is merely a means to an end, a place to serve your own needs. You might be idle in your work if you view your work as merely a means to an end, a place to serve your own needs. And this sounds like, I work so I can play. We've all heard people who do that. I work so I can play. Or the sanctified version is, I work so I can serve my church and give to my church, right? There you go. Number two, you might be idle in your work if your work totally frustrates you. This sounds like, nothing in this place or these people is worth this. Anyone feel like that? Ironically, every time I walk into the office in here, I'm like, what am I, you know, just joking. That is ironic, yes. You might feel that way. If you feel like I'm totally frustrated, nothing's worth it, this job is ridiculous because I can't handle the people or the place, then you might be idle in your work because we're prioritizing our comfort. Number three, your work becomes divorced from your Christian discipleship. This sounds like, I can't wait to get out of work and grow my faith in Bible study, Sunday morning service, or small group. This is under-identifying in our work because we are removing ourselves from the discipleship process that happens by doing what we were created to do, by participating in the renewal of all things. So we have, in this parable, an identification by the work, by the vineyard owner, of idleness in these workers' lives, and how everywhere he goes, everywhere he finds an idle person, he puts them to work. We find an owner who goes around finding idle people and puts them to work. And what the unique thing about the work that he puts them to is the fact that in the Jewish culture, vineyards were one of the most, or if not the most important, sources of income that they had. So this vineyard owner doesn't just show up and say, oh, you're idle, how about you come and sweep the steps? Yeah, you can sweep the steps. Yeah, do that. I'll hire you to do that. No, you can go, and I'm not demeaning sweeping the steps, right? But you can go do this, or you can go do that. What he invites them to do is he invites them into one of the most important roles that the Jewish culture has to offer. And we'll talk about how that's a really significant act of grace at the end. So I don't know about you, but I know I find myself on that idleness spectrum. There's a spectrum of idleness from doing nothing to, you know, doing something but not embodying that cultural mandate to our fullest in the work that we do. But there's another end of the spectrum, and that is idolatry in our work. If idleness is the under-identification in our work, where we don't embrace the cultural mandate in the stuff that we do, idolatry is an over-identification in the work we do, where we make this thing the God, the end-all, be-all of our lives. And we see this in the parable. We see it in verse 11 and verse 12, when the owner goes to hand out payment. Right? We see they stood in line. The people who got there first at 6 a.m., they're way in the back. The people who got there at 5, they started, so they get paid a denarius. And then the people in the back of the line, they're like, well, I've been here all day, so there's a good chance they're probably going to pay me more. Is that unreasonable? I don't think that's unreasonable, right? Like, well, I would maybe think that too, right? Oh, there's a good chance I'm going to get paid more because I've clearly done 11 more hours of work than these people. But when they get there, they receive the same pay as the people who were worked less than an hour. And what do they say? On receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house, saying, these last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat. It's like, oh, cry me a river, for right? They, it's not a problem. They don't really get into muddy waters when they say, you know what, I might actually get paid more. That'd be pretty cool, right? If they paid him a dollar or a denarius, then I might get a couple of denarius because I worked here. Maybe 11 times. I might get 11 denarius because I worked 11 times. And that's not problematic. The problem is that when they receive their denarius, they start to demonstrate and exhibit some signs of the fact that they've idolized their work, that they've over-identified in their work. Primarily, what they do is they start comparing themselves and assigning value to what they've done compared to what the others have done. They don't necessarily just come up humbly and say, yeah, hey, we're just wondering, because we worked like 11 more hours, is it possible that you could maybe give us more money? And did we earn it? What did we do wrong where you think that we didn't deserve more money, right? There's something called humble inquiry where you can go in and actually have that conversation. That's not out of the question. But what do? They approach him and they grumble and they say, they start adding qualifiers to the work they did. They say, not only did they work more, but they say, we bore the heavy burden in the scorching heat of the day. Almost telling the vineyard owner, I don't know if you're aware of what goes into running a vineyard, but it's not easy, all right? It got really hot out here, and we did a lot of work, and I don't know if you're aware, but we certainly are more valuable to you than those people. So they start comparing, and they start bargaining. They are over-identifying in their work. Now, you might see this in your work. You might see, how many work with people that there's always someone who is not really pulling their weight, right? There's always someone. I do this with my MBA students. One of the things that it's a fake little test for them, but I tell them, you're all gonna be put in the teams, so you gotta come with an idea of how you wanna put each other in the teams. And then by the end of the class, they're all freaking out because they haven't figured out how to put people in teams. Half of them don't wanna be in teams. You wanna know why? Because they've always had an experience with someone on a team where one person doesn't do any work and they just leech off everybody else's work, right? If you don't know anyone like that, you might be that person, all right? Do some self-diagnosis here. But we see this generally, right? We see the fact that we are prone to comparing ourselves, and not only comparing ourselves, there's a fairness thing, I get it, right? There's a wage structure where you get paid for doing things that are perceived as more valuable. But what happens is that we start adding value to it and say, okay, well, my work is more important than what that work is doing. And one of the really interesting illustrations of this is that, has anybody watched Netflix? Netflix junkies? Anyone watch the show Chef's Table? Any foodies out there? Okay, so one of the, begrudgingly as well, this he does, yeah. So Chef's Table is a beautiful documentary about, it's a couple seasons in, but it talks about, or it documents some of the greatest chefs in the world and their journey and their story. And even if you're not a foodie, it's just beautiful cinematography, production, it's fantastic. One of them in season two is a chef called Dominique Crenn. Dominique Crenn is the first Michelin, the first female chef to receive a Michelin star in America. All right, so she is top of her craft. She is one of the best chefs, let alone female chefs, in the country. And she has a couple restaurants in San Francisco. And they do a beautiful job of showing her story. And in her particular story, she actually, you can actually see, she's not a believer, has no faith, but you can see how she is embodying, she's not idle in her work in that she doesn't under-identify, because she is creating beautiful food and she's creating beautiful experiences for the people who visit her restaurant. And she has a couple quotes in there where she says, as she was considering her journey from being a line cook in hotels to opening her own restaurant and kind of helping see her vision come true. And she says this, she says, "I need to do something that matters. Did I want to just open a restaurant or open a space where I could create something?" That's a pretty great identification with that culture mandate that we talked about when it comes to the culinary arts. If we all thought that way around our own works, we could say, I didn't want to just do something that doesn't matter. I want to create something. Even if that's in your own role, what you're doing, you want to create something. But literally, seconds later, we see a little bit of the idolatry coming out. She says this. She's talking about her experience in a hotel as a hotel line cook. She says, "I struggled with guests who weren't open to things." This is, if you could see her face, it'd be great. She goes, "Thousand Island dressing? Ranch dressing? What? That made me cringe." Who here likes Thousand Island dressing? Now everyone's like, nope, not me. Ranch dressing, I think it's great. You know, I love to put stuff on. There's this, we see exactly in, and I'm not here to throw stones at Dominique Crenn, right? She doesn't believe in Jesus, we don't expect anything. We see even in our own lives that we identify the same thing. I'm not here to publicly shame Dominique Crenn, but what we see is a perfect illustration of somebody who is embodying, they're not under-identifying by idleness, but they're over-identifying in their work, because she says she wants to create this hospitable environment in her restaurants where all the menu is a poem, and they have these, they walk through this experience, this culinary experience. And I would question, how is that qualitatively different than somebody who opens their home and serves salad with ranch dressing on it, creating the same hospitable environment and creating and eating a meal together, sharing a meal together, and sharing life together? What is the qualitative difference? The qualitative difference is that Dominique Crenn thinks that what she's doing is infinitely more valuable because it's beautiful food. It's incredibly delicious. She's working with all these different flavors, inventing all these different methods of cooking. And that's problematic because we're over-identifying. We are assigning value and comparing ourselves to what other people are doing. And if we're honest with ourselves, I think we do that regularly in our own lives. Every day, we have the capacity to look our nose down at somebody else and say, what they're doing is not important. What I'm doing is important. Or what I'm doing is not important enough. I need to go find something that actually matters. We are over-identifying with our work. We are making that the single most important thing in our lives. And what happens when we do that, when we make an idol of our work, and really what an idol of our work just means is that we replace God with our work. Work is good. We've been mandated to do it. God has graciously allowed us to do it, injects purpose and meaning into the stuff that we do, but we've taken this good thing and we just make it the ultimate thing in our lives. And why this is problematic is three specific reasons. First, we have elevated the created over the creator. We have decided what is the ultimate thing in our lives. And not only the created, but if you go back to Genesis, when God describes the curse of sin and how it affects our work, he actually says, you're gonna toil and sweat until the day you return to the dust. Right? You've heard this before. From dust you were created, from dust you will return. And so it's when we worship and idolize our work and over-identify, we actually are not even idolizing dust. We're idolizing the stuff that dust does, right? Which is weird. And so we elevate, the ultimate problem is that we elevate the created over the creator. The second thing we do is that if you've connected, if you have a job that you love and you over-identify, our idol of work is an insatiable God. It is never satisfied. The idol of work will continue to take and take and take and take without end. You may have experienced this in your work where you are on a deadline. You say, I'm going to work through this week. I'm going to power through. We're going to get this deadline done. then I'm going to rest, back to normal. What happens next month? We got another deadline. We got to power through another weekend, right? You might say to yourself, well, I really want to get promoted because I want this thing. Well, once you get that promotion, what's next? The next promotion. And so what do we do when we idolize our work is that it's insatiable and we end up sacrificing everything on the altar of our work. We have a great time reading Old Testament language and how these people are sacrificing their kids to these gods and we're disgusted. And yet, some of us might, if we over-identify in our work, we sacrifice our families, our kids on the altar of our work regularly because we're not home, we're not engaged, we don't have any time for them. We are constantly worshiping our work idol. And it never, ever, ever is satiated. So that's problematic. And finally, it's ultimately problematic because our work cannot bear the weight of our worship. Work was designed to be purposeful. God mandated it. But when we put the weight of our worship and our identity on our work, it can't bear the weight because eventually that thing is not God and it will crumble, it'll go away, it'll disappoint us. It cannot bear the weight. And you might have experienced this if you ever get laid off. You walk into your work one morning, you got a job, you walk out that night, you don't have a job. Maybe something happens where you get fired. Maybe something happens where things just don't work out. You don't get the promotion that you want. You put all your hope and faith in that promotion. I can do it, I can do it. Suddenly you don't get it. Your world crumbles. It can't bear the weight of our worship. So you might be thinking, I don't know, do I idolize my work? Am I over-identifying in my work? We also have three identifiers that you can help diagnose yourself. The first one is, if your work is your primary source of satisfaction, you might be an idolater in work. This sounds like, I was made to do this and nothing else. If that's your only source of satisfaction, if that thing goes away, you're no longer satisfied, you might be idolizing your work. Number two is your work is all about being the best you can so you can make a name for yourself. This is probably the one that I fall into the most. The very fact that I'm up here is the hesitancy to even come up here and preach is because I don't like failure. I don't want to not do something that I'm not the best at. So I know, you know, you come up here and you, it's not like I've been preaching 8,500 messages into myself in the mirror, right? This is the first time I come up here in a long time. So this is the one that I fall into, and it sounds like this. The things people will say about me when they see this. And the last one, your work becomes primarily about making a difference in the world. This sounds like if it's not helping people, it's not worth doing. And this is a really interesting one because we're generally told to do something that matters, that contributes to society, that helps people. But if you can't fathom doing something in your work that doesn't help people, you have over-identified in your role in creation. It's God's job to make sure that everyone is taken care of. It's our job to play a small part in that. And if you can't see what you're doing, if you have to help people, then that's a problem. You've over-identified in your work. And so this is some really helpful insight from this parable. We get a good look at the way people idolize their work and the way they are idle in their work. But ultimately, this parable is not about the workers. This parable is about the vineyard owner, the master of the house. And we talked at the beginning about how work is broken, how we cannot fix it. It's poisoned by sin, and that causes us to be idle, and it causes us to be idolatrous in our work. But when we look at this parable through the lens of the worker, the house owner is the focus and the highlight, it changes things. Because what we see is a gracious, compassionate, inviting homeowner who invites broken people into a life of purpose and meaning. We see a homeowner who goes out and finds idle people and gives them purpose and meaning. Not just small purpose and meaning, but big purpose and meaning. Come participate in the most important economic venture in Israel. And if you know anything, right, the parable starts with the kingdom of heaven is like. So in this case, the homeowner is God. We are the workers. God shows up, and despite the fact that we are idle, we're broken, we are not contributing or fulfilling the cultural mandate God gave us, he still shows up with his grace and invites us into meaningful, purposeful work as a complete and total act of his grace in our lives. We also see a homeowner or a vineyard owner who comes out and rewards the idolatrous. I don't want you to think, oh, he's telling me to go be idolatrous and God will reward me, right? No, what he does is he has people who are his employees who he has hired graciously, found them doing nothing, gave them something purposeful to do, and he has these people show up and question his authority and start saying, wait, no, I'm more important. Can't you see that what I'm doing is more important? And we start over-identifying and worshiping the work. But despite that, he graciously rewards those people. And ultimately, when we look at the big picture, this is really important for us because if history teaches us anything, we're in a lot of trouble as humans because we keep trying to fix things. We keep trying, even though we understand the cultural mandate, we think things are important, but we continue to ruin work and we can't seem to fix it. And ultimately, the most important part is that despite our brokenness, the vineyard owner, God, in his graciousness, allows us to be a part of it and redeems the work for us. And why can he do this? He can do it because he has the authority to do it. And in this case, who is the person that does that? Jesus is the one with the authority to do this. He has the authority to invite us into meaningful work because when he was on earth, he was never idle in his work. Jesus showed up and did exactly what he was supposed to do. Lived perfectly, died horribly, rose from the dead. Sounds like a pretty productive life to me. In the same way, Jesus has the authority to reward idolaters because Jesus showed up and never once made an idol of his own work. He said, not my will, but yours. So we get to stand here and look at, yes, the world's broken, work is broken, but we live in the paradox that the Christian faith provides us of, you're called to do great things, also don't over-identify it. Why? We can sit there and rest in that paradox because we have a God who approves of us, who loves us, and invites us purely based on his grace to be a part of it. And so when we leave here, I don't want you to leave here thinking, okay, here's all this way, I'm not gonna be an idol. I'm not gonna idolize my work. Here's how I'm gonna do it. Or I'm not going to make an idol of my work. I'm going to do this, this, this. I don't want you to walk out of here thinking of all the stuff you're going to do for God. I want you to walk out of here being reminded of all the stuff God did for you to invite you into meaningful, purposeful work. And let me give you a little heads up. Spoiler, we're all going to screw it up. But God's grace is sufficient. The vineyard owner has invited us to meaningful, purposeful work, even though we're going to screw it up. We're going to worship other things. So in the next couple songs, I want you to sing a little bit, do a little bit of reflection. Really, the first response is always to repent and say, God, I'm getting it wrong, but you got it right. And then we can celebrate what God did for us. So let's sing together.